The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's kind of a numbers game right now, with the faces of the desperate on each and every one of those numbers. Can Europe accept 160,000 refugee migrants? That's the latest proposal from the Middle East. 160,000 out of more than 4 million.
I really hope that this time everyone will be on board. No poems, no rhetorics. Action is what is needed for the time being.
That's European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker speaking this week as Danish police closed the railway between Denmark and Germany because 300 refugees, including children, began walking the tracks. There is something petty and superficial about these quotas as Europe negotiates. What are they based on? Who can say how many people Denmark or Hungary can or should accept? It brings to mind the expression women and children first, the protocol when sailing vessels were evacuated into lifeboats. There was no quota. It was get the helpless and innocent out first, period. This impulse was behind the very humble but heroic rescue effort that brought thousands of refugee Jewish children from Nazi Germany to the UK between 1938 and 1940. It was small scale, it came despite the reluctance of nations to accept displaced people, and it was called Kindertransport. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks served as chief rabbi of the UK from 1991 and 2013, and he believes that a Kindertransport gesture is needed today for the thousands of refugee children crowding the EU borders. Now Rabbi Sacks says it's as important for the world, including the United States, to offer hope as well as sanctuary for the thousands left behind and waiting, which he says is exactly what Kindertransport managed to do back in the 1930s.
Jews had been trying to leave Germany, and in July 1938, 32 countries came together in the French spa town of Evian to discuss the crisis. And basically what happened was every nation closed its doors. And it was in the midst of this that a few heroic individuals organized this rescue by train of 10,000 Jewish children from Germany. And it became the great spot of light in the midst of one of the dark periods of human history.
The period of post-Holocaust Europe did not have the divisions between Muslim and Jew that we understand today. Is there anything about that time and that sense of, or lack of, xenophobia between Muslims and Jews that could help us in this time to assimilate Muslims, to welcome Muslims, to embrace the Muslims who are trapped in Syria?
Well, I certainly think, and I tried to do this for all those decades, two and a bit decades that I was chief rabbi in Britain, to say that we should be exporting a message of coexistence from Britain to the Middle East instead of importing a message of conflict from the Middle East to Britain. Because in Britain, we got on very well, the Jewish and Muslim communities. We worked at that relationship. Locally in Britain, we have managed those relationships well. But there is a huge spillover in Europe of the politics of the Middle East, because today, with all our global media, a conflict anywhere very rapidly becomes a conflict everywhere.
Why is it so hard for Israelis to imagine Nahariya or Haifa or other territories inside of Israel or even the West Bank as being a sanctuary for some of these people from Syria? It's, in some cases, walking distance.
Oh, I'm sure they would want to provide sanctuary, as they've done at a medical level, very much so. I mean, there are a lot of Syrians being treated in Israeli hospitals at the moment, and you've got Israeli doctors going out to where the great mass of refugees are. Because of the political sensitivities, these acts of medical aid and so on are being done well beneath the radar screen. But I know they're happening. And I know there are Syrian refugees being treated in Israeli hospitals at the moment.
I'm glad to hear that. As someone who's spent plenty of time in the Middle East myself, you know, looking at the ironies of history and the tragedies of history, and there are plenty in that region, do you think the inability, for whatever reason, for the Arabs and the Israelis in Palestine and Israel to deal with the repatriation questions of refugees from 1948 and 1967 has caused an opportunity to be lost for Israel to project itself as a sanctuary, which it certainly was for Jews after World War II.
Look, I think it's continued to be a sanctuary. There's no question that Israel is one of the only two countries in the world, the United States being the other, which was built on and exists as a refuge for asylum seekers. There's no doubt that Israel has offered asylum, but at the same time, you understand that many Syrians themselves, they are worried that if they take refuge in Israel, they will never be allowed back into Syria. That's the real problem.
Would you say that what you know about, and you've talked about a lot that's under the radar, is a policy of the Netanyahu government that they welcome sanctuary in Israel?
No. I mean, this is part of the deep-rooted Israeli feeling that we're here to be a blessing. You know, we're in our synagogue this Saturday. We're all going to read those famous words of Moses at the end of his life. I set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. Choose life. I think Israel is predicated on that principle of choose life. So they've always tried to do this. And I think the international isolation of Israel has inhibited that and set up barriers where there really should not be barriers.
Should the U.S. do more?
I have the feeling it is an enormous country that has thus far taken in relatively few refugees from the Middle East. But as a British visitor here, the last thing I would wish to do is tell America how to deal with this.
Why not?
Because I try and be polite, and Europe is finding it hard
enough. Is it impolite to suggest that America, who invaded Iraq and perhaps created the circumstances for much of this migration, should not bear a greater responsibility? Is that something that we restrain from talking about because we're polite?
Okay, I'm going to be very blunt.
Let's do that.
Let's be very blunt. I think humanitarian gestures go further to change the climate of international politics than military interventions. Military interventions leave behind a legacy of resentment. Humanitarian interventions leave behind a legacy of gratitude. So if I were talking about long-term winning the peace, I would say that being a home for refugees is probably the single most effective thing Europe and the United States can do.
So, you know, billions for weapons, but a single gesture of Kinder transport from Damascus to Washington, D.C.,
yeah,
or some courageous Israeli standing up and saying, Hassan in Raqqa, come and live with me. This changes the world, whereas more weapons.
Correct. More weapons simply reinforce all the conflicts of the past and allow us to replay and replay and replay conflicts which are never resolved.
So, Rabbi, where's the courage? It seems so simple. It's not like, not simple, like stupid simple, but it just...
I think Angela Merkel is showing that courage right now.
Really?
I think she's talking about bringing in as many as 800,000 refugees. That would be far more than all of the rest of Europe put together. This is courageous, and it is very clearly being driven by a sense of historical memory, pain, grief, guilt, an attempt to redeem the past.
So then, and I'm no theologian, but that redemption is an option for America too.
I think so.
That redemption is an option for the Gulf countries, who have much to answer for.
Correct.
In all of this.
Correct.
If you were standing on deck of a ship that was loaded with children from Syria who were headed to destinations unknown, but sanctuary assured, but with a future full of question marks, What would you advise them? What would you tell them to reassure them based on your knowledge of history?
I think it was an American historian who calculated that there have only been 29 years of peace since human civilization began. So war is the eternal story. But I think too much hope has been sucked out of the atmosphere of the Middle East. And although it's another subject for another time, I do believe that Jews, Christians, and Muslims have to come together and say we are all members of the family of Abraham. And there is such a thing as reconciliation. Genesis is full of sibling rivalries, but it ends with reconciliation between Joseph and his brothers. And bear in mind the fact that Joseph's brothers wanted to kill him and eventually sold him as a slave. So I think that the children of Abraham have a literature of hope. And I think I would sit with those children and talk those stories through and say, that is your story and it is my story, and together we can build a world if we're willing to make that our story today as well.
Lord Jonathan Sacks served as Chief Rabbi of the United Hebrew Congregations of the Commonwealth from 1991 to 2013. Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Thank you.
As humanitarians like Rabbi Sacks call on the world to do more, they also warn against rhetoric that suggests any of this is easy or addressable with military means or Donald Trump-style border walls. In fact, here's candidate Trump sounding annoyed about taking more Syrian refugees in the United States as though they were something left behind on one of his construction sites.
I hate the concept of it, but on a humanitarian basis with what's happening, you have to. You know, this was started by President Obama when he didn't go in and do the job when he should have, when he drew the line in the sand, which turned out to be a very artificial line.
Going in to do what job? Nice sounding lines in the sand that get covered with blood in the chaos of civil war. How we got here is not going to help us get out of this. It's a lesson about clarity and being able to focus on what is important in times of crisis. And that's exactly what the Kinders Transport Program managed to do. It didn't stop World War II. It didn't topple Hitler. It did save thousands of lives. British humanitarian Sir Nicholas Winton was a man who saw the shadow descending on Europe in the 1930s and set up the rescue of Jewish kids from Czechoslovakia. He lived until he was 106. He spoke about what he had done just before his death when he told the BBC of his sadness about the world once again failing to see what he saw so long ago.
I don't think we ever learn from the mistakes of the past. I mean, we are now, the world today is in a more dangerous situation than it has ever been. And so long as you've got the weapons of mass destruction, which can finish off any conflict, nothing is safe anymore.
British humanitarian Sir Nicholas Winton. This is The Takeaway.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. You can also check out the latest John Hockenberry blog post and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
Oh, it seems to me that siren seems to be the hardest word.
Why is this apparently easy?
When I got to work as Secretary of State, I opted for convenience to use my personal email account, which was allowed by the State Department, because I thought it would be easier to carry just one device for my work and for my personal emails instead of two.
Why is rationalizing an oversight about emails when you are in a sensitive government position like Secretary of State, why is that easy? And this, why is this still pretty easy? The regret thing.
I regret that this has become such a cause celebre.
The responsibility thing.
I take responsibility.
The I made bad choices thing.
I certainly wish that I had made a different choice.
And then there's the very considerate, sorry for confusing you, people of America.
At the end of the day, I am sorry that this has been confusing to people.
All that acrobatic dodging and weaving is easy. But this exchange with David Muir of ABC News, this apparently is hard.
I should have used two accounts, one for personal, one for work-related emails. That was a mistake. I'm sorry about that. I take responsibility. And I'm trying to be as transparent as I possibly can.
Did you make a mistake?
I did. I did.
Edwin Battistella is the author of Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology. He joins us from Southern Oregon. Edwin, does that constitute an apology, and why does it take so long for candidate Clinton, with a lot at stake? I mean, she is running for president, to get there.
This is something that's really kind of typical with politicians. They often don't feel they're at fault and struggle with how to say they have some regrets for things and never quite get around to apologizing until lots of other shoes fall and there's a kind of groundswell for people to apologize. So I think people that let this drag on too long are getting some bad advice.
And the pressure to say sorry, some of our listeners have responded to. I say sorry often. One of our folks from Massachusetts says it's become a crutch. And I think about how I can be better about holding myself to higher standards. I am a people pleaser who can't say no. It is difficult when we are so busy and have so many demands. Somehow this person is saying that sorry has become cheapened. Apologies are cheap for some class of people.
One of the things that I noticed in doing the research for Sorry About That, that I was becoming a better apologizer. So now I apologize less, but I apologize quickly when I've done something wrong. And I think that's true. You know, apologies are kind of a ritual that we use to either shame something we've done or repair a relationship. If I step on your foot in the movies, it's basically a sort of simple ritual. It's become, in our 24-hour news cycle, something that is really on demand, almost.
Hi, this is Paul from Philadelphia. I actually find that a sincere apology is a lot easier to give than it first seems. And once you develop a habit for it, you'll never want to go back. Thanks.
Some advice there from Paul in Philly. Can you make a habit of apologies without being obsequious?
I think you can be a good apologizer. What really strikes me as necessary is thinking about the apology before you make it. So I've been in situations where I might say, I'm sorry, can you tell me the time, or things like that. And now I'm saying more things like, excuse me.
Edwin Battistella is author of Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology. He spoke with us from Southern Oregon. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's a sad, sad situation, and it's getting more and more absurd.
I certainly wish that I had made a different choice.
It's sad, so, so sad.
I am sorry.
Why can't we talk it over?
There are answers to all these questions.
Oh, it seems to me that sorry seems to be the hardest word. What do I do?
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Going back to school this year has become a life and death struggle for some hunger strikers in Chicago protesting the closure in June of the Walter H. Diet High School building, one of 53 schools to shut down since an initiative in 2013 led by Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel.
It's tough. It's very difficult. But it has to be done so we can achieve the goal that every parent and everybody in the city wants, which is a child to have a high-quality education.
When Diet was open, it was the last open enrollment high school in Chicago's Bronzeville neighborhood. Responding to neighborhood pressure, though, Chicago school officials have agreed to reopen Diet, but only as a high school for the arts. The hunger strike goes on. It's the 25th day without food, only liquids. April Stogner is an education activist in the Bronzeville community. She's gone without food for more than 3 weeks. April, how are you feeling?
Hi, John. I'm doing well.
Now, what is your reason for striking at this point, given that the city is going to reopen the school as an arts academy?
Well, John, let me first say that the decision to reopen Diet as an open enrollment school, we kind of already had that decision last year to reopen it. What we've been fighting for is to have it as the global leadership school. What they're trying to give us is not what the community asked for. They never brought us to the table to make this decision. Many people think that it's a win for us. but we don't see it as that. We don't feel that that's victorious. And for that reason, that's why we're in day 25 of the hunger strike.
What kind of school do you envision Diet to be if it were to reopen under the conditions that you are setting?
I would envision Diet being a school that's connected to the other schools in the community, the grammar schools. You're talking about a school that has a beautiful garden, rooftop where you can have a garden. Everything is geared toward green technology, where our kids will be ensured to have a future in green technology and be ensured that they'll have jobs. Yeah, we like arts and all that. That's all fine and dandy. But our kids can do more than dance and sing and jump around.
Isn't the mayor's office line here, though, that this school is inefficient, that it is not green because it's old architecture, it's old, open, poorly insulated, that sort of thing?
That is not true. It's crazy that when I was listening to the statement that you played by the mayor, and they always say that they want to do what's best for the children. This is not what's best for our children. When you talk about community, the community should be involved in these decisions, and we were not involved. We submitted this plan. We've been working on this plan for well over 5 years. So it's funny that he says, you're doing what's best for our community. You don't know what's best for our community, or we wouldn't have had 49 schools closing at one time. Tell the truth and say what it is. They just want to make money off the backs of our children, and they feel like they can just come in our community and take what they want, but we're not having that anymore.
How far are you prepared to go with this?
I'm willing to take this as far as it needs to go. I've been hungry for 25 days. I'm willing to go 25 more if I need to. We just know that what they're handing us is just crumbs. It's crumbs, and they want us to feel like it's cake, and we are not going for that. We know what good schools look like. I wouldn't see the children at Mollison Elementary, where my grandson attends. I would not see children eating their lunch on the floor in the hallway because it's overcrowded, because you decided to close a school and merge these schools together and there wasn't enough room. When you say that, you have the kids' best interest at heart. What kids are you talking about? Because it's not the kids in Bronzeville that you're talking about. It's not the black and brown students that I look at every day.
April, what does your grandson say about what you're doing here?
Well, my grandson, I brought him out yesterday with me for the first time because I felt like he needed to know why. When they're at home eating and grandma is just drinking water, why she isn't eating. I need him to understand that you are important. You do matter. I don't want him to believe that people can just come in his neighborhood and tell him he's not good enough to have a school to go to up the street from him, a good community school, a great community school, a world-class community school. He needs to know whatever you believe in, you stand up and you fight for by any means necessary.
So many people have asked the question since 2008, during the financial meltdown, et cetera, why doesn't protest work? Why aren't the protests angrier? Why don't they have more of an impact? In your case, I mean, if people start dying over there, you could really change the game as far as protests are concerned in 2015.
I think we have already changed the game. I didn't think that this would go this far. I didn't think that people would watch people starve just for an education for their children. It's amazing to me that we are labeled as people who don't care, parents that don't care. I don't see anybody who doesn't care going without food for 25 days for the education of their children, going to jail for the education of their children. This is bigger than just diet. This is about human and civil rights at this point. This is not just a local issue. This has become a national issue. It's going on everywhere.
The mayor thinks you're bluffing now. I mean, he's going to hold out.
Well, that remains to be seen. The mayor, wow, that's probably one of the biggest gangsters I've seen in a long time.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. I would have to say anyone who doesn't value our kids, that already speaks to what kind of person our mayor is. Anyone who closes schools, those are community institutions. Where else would our children have to go?
Although schools do have to be closed sometimes and things have to be changed and, old buildings need to be replaced by new buildings.
What schools need are to be invested in, not disinvested in. It's easy to take away all the resources from these children in these schools and say that they're failing. But what did you do to make sure that they were excelling? You took everything. They don't have libraries, no resources. You take out all of our Black and brown teachers, people who love and care about our kids, who can teach them their history. That's not what you want. But you have money for charters, turnaround schools. I have a problem with that. Everybody should have a problem with that.
April, we want to talk to you later on this month, hopefully, and I hope things turn out well for you. Is there someone in your group of hunger strikers who's particularly fragile at this point?
I think we're all fragile. It's dangerous. And you want to talk to me later this month, I just pray to God that I'm still here and around to talk to you.
Well, we do the same. April Stogner is a hunger striker and education activist in the Bronzeville community of Chicago. She spoke to us from station WBEZ in Chicago.
Thank you for having me.
In the annals of unforeseen consequences, an astute writer and historian has taken a case of organized child abuse that captivated the nation back in the 1980s and shown how it grew out of a vast series of changes in the U.S. involving the economy, families, and child care. In 1983, teachers at the McMartin Preschool in Southern California were accused of sexually abusing young students. After the police sent a letter to 200 families asking parents to talk to their kids about possible abuse, what came back looked like a horror show going on in a tranquil suburb of L.A.
What happens then is the parents start to talk to their kids, and then they start to talk to each other, and then they start to compare notes, and pretty soon emotionally involved parents are engaging and leading in suggestive questioning of their child.
FBI agent Kenneth Lanning consulted on the McMartin case back in the 1980s. The allegations produced a court case that inspired other daycare abuse scandals across the country, but in the end, it was all the product of children's imagination, bad questioning techniques by professionals, and something deeper. Richard Beck, editor at N Plus One and author of We Believe the Children, A Moral Panic in the 1980s, says this was a mass hysteria that grew out of collective fears and guilt over the growing use of daycare and from the use of sloppy psychology to explain a complicated social transformation taking place at the end of the 20th century.
The allegations came almost entirely out of interviews that social workers and therapists conducted with the children who had attended the preschool. And these interviews, if you look at the transcript, it's clear that they were unintentionally conducted in a very coercive way, such that children would start off their interviews, you know, and these are young kids, like 4, 5, and 6, would start off saying, "No, nothing happened to me at daycare. The teachers are fine." And it gradually became clear to the kids that that wasn't the kind of answer that the therapists were looking for. And eventually, realizing that the interview is not going to end until they start providing those kinds of answers, they began to make things up. So when you got into a courtroom, We Believe the Children became a real mantra for prosecutors and for parents, because that was the whole substance of the case, was the testimony that they claimed had come spontaneously from these kids.
At the time in the 1980s, the intuitive feel for what was going on at the McMartin case and the McMartin preschool was that why would kids lie about something like this? Why would kids make up something like this so it must be true? In fact, what was intuitively believed to be evidence that condemned the McMartin preschool suddenly became a psychological phenomenon that absolutely exonerated them.
The detection of child sexual abuse in daycare centers, the idea that this was a social problem we had to deal with, that was very new. So there weren't a lot of protocols in place, safeguards for conducting forensic interviews with these kids. In LA, there was a guy working named Roland Summit who published a paper called The Child Sexual Abuse Accommodation Syndrome, which was a description of how he thought kids dealt with the after effects of being sexually abused. And one of the things he said was that children will be very reluctant to reveal what's happened to them, so that you have to press them pretty hard. And then at the end of that process, after they've revealed what's happened, if they maybe go back and try to say, wait, I maybe didn't tell the entire truth, that may not be entirely what happened, if they try to retract those allegations, the idea was that that should also be taken as further confirmation that they had, in fact, been sexually abused.
How did the issue of Satanism and the idea that this was actually some deeper cult get into the entire trial and this sort of national hysteria?
Well, Satanism was kind of an ambient cultural fear that had been floating around since the 1970s. I think it's tied to a certain extent to the rise of evangelical Christianity. Also, the Church of Satan really had been founded in San Francisco in 1969, and its founder, Anton LaVey, was a real charismatic, very mediagenic kind of personality. The way that those allegations began to work their way into the daycare trials was first, there was kind of, as a corollary to the daycare trials, you have the phenomenon of recovered memory therapy happening at around the same time, in which psychotherapists working with adult patients would use hypnosis and large doses of very powerful drugs to get them to try to dig out memories of abuse from their childhood. And those memories sometimes turned out to be satanic.
How much do you think the backdrop of America's changing economy contributed to a sense of guilt here, in the sense that parents feel guilty about having to use daycare, and that the daycare centers were under a suspicion just because people didn't want to have to do that anymore with so many two-income households growing around the country?
Yeah, the economy plays a role. I think my argument is a little bit more shaded toward the social. I think that just the social and cultural status of the nuclear family had really begun to change in dramatic and permanent ways in the 1970s. You know, and some of the impetus for that was economic. Some of the impetus for it, a lot of it, was a result of the women's movement in the 70s. You had really unprecedented numbers of women entering the workforce, and you also had a skyrocketing divorce rate. So you would see these kind of anxious think pieces about, you know, what does it mean if I'm a woman and I take a job and have to leave my kid in daycare? You know, how is that going to affect his development? And these cases really just crystallized and dramatized all of those fears in the worst possible way.
How did therapists change their view of what they were doing because of this case? Really just rethink the entire field that had spawned all of these trials?
Well, professional psychiatry was one of the fields where you really did see reform in the wake of these cases, you know, which I don't think you saw much of in law enforcement or in the judiciary. But therapists, the thing they did in interviews with children was they came up with pretty good protocols for separating out or distinguishing forensic interviews from therapeutic interviews. So, right, a forensic interview is an interview where you just need to find out exactly what happened, whereas a therapeutic interview is there so you can look out for the emotional well-being of the child. And there are many instances in therapeutic interviews where maybe you prioritize some emotional component of what's going on over the literal truth of what happened. So those are much more separated now.
Richard Beck, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Richard Beck is an editor at N Plus One and the author of We Believe the Children, A Moral Panic in the 1980s. Take this with you today. As always, when we pose a question, our community serves up stories that top the headlines. For instance, whatever Hillary Clinton has done to apologize to America over her email problems as Secretary of State, it doesn't even come close to the degree of difficulty of these apologies.
Hi, this is Sue from Hillsborough, New Jersey. So my hardest apology ever, ever was saying sorry to my two daughters because I was breaking up the family by filing for divorce.
My name is Wes Meehan. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. Without thinking, I once told my two teenage sons that parenting was the hardest job I had ever done. And if I had to do it over again, I would think long and hard. Of course, it was an incredibly stupid thing to say. And I have apologized to them at least 30 times in the past 10 years. They are in their 30s now and have forgiven me, but I will still feel bad about it till the day I die.
Oklahoma City. I was 8 and my parents had just separated. They weren't really speaking to each other. My dad had us that Christmas and he tried to make it special. My siblings opened their gifts. They all got toys. I was sure I was getting a toy. Instead, I got ugly red shoes. I sat them in front of his bedroom door so that he knew I didn't want them. When my mom came to pick us up, my dad actually talked to her, gave her the shoes and the receipt, and asked her to get me a toy. I would really like to say sorry for that, but it was 21 years ago. I think you've said you're sorry. And Wes, we're taking you off the hook there. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.